KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, a conversation with one of the nation's leading writers of both fiction and nonfiction. Joyce Carol Oates will be joining us. Her most recent novel is called The Gravedigger's Daughter. It's the story of a family of Holocaust survivors in Upper State New York. Though the novel ends here in San Francisco at a musical recital, the novel focuses on the youngest member of the Schwartz family, Rebecca, who flees from domestic abuse. Joyce Carol Oates joins us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Joyce Carol Oates is a National Book Award and Penn Faulkner Award-winning novelist, as well as the Roger S. Berlin Distinguished Professor of Humanities at Princeton. Her newest novel, which took 12 years to write, is called The Gravedigger's Daughter. It is the story of a violence and strife-afflicted family who escaped the Holocaust to Upper New York State, where the father, a math teacher in Germany, becomes a graveyard caretaker. At the center of the novel is the youngest daughter, Rebecca, who, as a victim of domestic abuse with a man she believed was her husband, becomes another kind of survivor and escapes with her son. Rebecca creates a new identity for the two of them and calls herself Hazel Jones, a name that a menacing man whom she encounters early on in the novel believes her to be. Now, that's just scratching the surface, obviously, but Joyce Carol Oates joins us for this hour of Forum, and welcome. Glad to have you back here.
Thank you.
This is new territory for you. Survivors of the Holocaust, an immigrant story, to some extent it's new terrain. And of course, I was struck, as I suspect many of your readers will be, by the dedication in memoriam to the name Morgenstern, which appears in the novel. And I remember once you're saying on the air that there was a murder in your family, and there's a murder, of course, in this novel in the family. I'm not going to ask you the silly question about how much is fiction, but it was inspired by family history, huh?
Yes, basically my grandmother, who was my father's mother, is the gravedigger's daughter. And I never knew her as a girl, of course, still less as a child, and I never knew her family. But I learned as an adult some of the details of her difficult childhood. So I wanted to imagine a young woman who is modeled after my grandmother in some ways, but of course is a fictitious character also.
It means you have Jewish blood, so to speak, that
yes.
You didn't know about, or did you know about?
Well, I didn't actually know about it, no, until I was quite mature. My father didn't know that he was Jewish either.
It's like Christopher Hitchens, who discovered sort of late in life that he had that background as well. This is really Rebecca's story, I mean, more than it is anybody else, but we get a lot of profiles of different men around her, and they're a bad lot. Eventually she meets up with Mr. Gallagher, who is a wonderful and nice man and kind of a antithesis of this, but there's so much ugliness and profile of men in connection with violence that I've, beginning with the man in the Panama hat, and I'm not going to give away anything here, wondering about that. As you've written more, it seems to me you've been drawn more to the world of victimization through domestic violence and the kind of ugliness that takes place on a regular basis. I mean, you've always written about it, but you're writing about it more, it seems, are you?
I'm very fascinated by the ways in which people get out of these situations. I think of Rebecca, who becomes Hazel Jones, as someone who survived and led a very, ultimately, a very enhanced life by her own effort, by an act of will. I really almost never write about people who are only victims, but I'm concerned with the social context that people come from.
You're also concerned, of course, as you said a number of times, about your work with the psychology, and the psychology of the father, of Rebecca's father, is quite disturbing. I mean, he's a very disturbed man. How much of that is linked, maybe you can't say as a novelist, but how much of it is linked to the experiences in Europe and what he went through?
Well, I think 90% of it, or 95%. He had been one of many Jews, German Jews who had assumed that they were assimilated into the German society. He had thought that he was German. He was not a religious Jew, and he may have even had some feeling of independence from being Jewish. He might have felt superior to his religious background. He was an agnostic, and he would have identified himself as a German citizen. He went to the university, he studied philosophy, and he was a math teacher. And then, as the Nazis came into power, and anti-Semitism became ever more oppressive and visible, he was forced out of his job, and he was sensitive enough to anticipate that there was no future for a Jew and his family in Germany in 1936. So he left, but many Jews at that time did not want to confront this. We think in retrospect that it must have been obvious that they should have fled if they could. But I think I'm much more sympathetic with people who are in a state of denial. They just can't believe that something so horrific may be coming. They basically could not believe it.
Or that it could happen to them, especially when they're good German citizens, like you say. But I was thinking, because there are all these, the metaphors of rats that get into his system and the damage that's done to him, and he becomes a very damaged character and damages others as a result. I thought about Elie Wiesel once talking about, you know, two people who go through terrible trauma in the Holocaust. One becomes, you know, saintly almost and philanthropic and does extraordinary things, and the other, you know, becomes like the pawnbroker, or becomes, you know, attracted to the darker side, or just angry and forlorn.
Well, which do you think you would have been?
That's a wonderful question. I probably might have turned, you know, angry and nihilistic, I think. I mean, it afflicts me bad, you know, just with life's vicissitudes as it is. But I raise the question here because he becomes so much that way, and yet he was schooled in Schopenhauer, and so he was schooled kind of to begin with.
To be somewhat pessimistic. Yeah. Well, I think it's a very interesting question, and it's almost a philosophical question. There may be some region where the philosophical dimension and something like the physiological conjoin, where we have a biochemical predilection to be optimistic or pessimistic, some of us. Some of us are much more naturally depressive. Others are more optimistic. A person who is deeply pessimistic or skeptical, let's say skeptical, sees that his skepticism is confirmed by events in history. A person who is naturally optimistic will acknowledge that history is tragic, but still there are exceptions. And I think it's a matter of our personalities. I was presenting Jacob Swart as someone whom I didn't really judge. I thought that he had a strong case for seeing the world in these very dark terms, and I would not judge him.
Animal life that's weak are quickly disposed of. I mean, that seems to be his worldview. It's a very kind of uber-Darwinian view, isn't it?
But isn't it true?
Well, you know, actually...
But shouldn't we say that? Should we not say things that are true? We should say things that are nice.
No. I remember another conversation we had, though. We were talking about Darwin, and somebody said, what about masochism? How does masochism fit into natural selection? And
very well, I would say.
Do you think so? Yeah. I remember we just remembered that conversation.
But isn't this a question also? Should we say things that are true, or should we say things that are nice? Women are confronted with that all the time.
Not only women, we're all confronted with it, aren't
we? That's right, but particularly women, because women are supposed to be nice. A man can be outspoken and frank and even aggressive. A man can have a certain very strong personality and be admired. But a woman with a strong personality is not by nature going to be, I mean, not naturally going to be admired.
But even some of us aggressive men like to be nice and want to win and curry favor with our niceness. It gets back to, I remember an essay that you wrote about how so often you're accused of seeing things too darkly and so forth. And your rejoinder to that has always been, as it was in this essay, that you see things the way they really are. And you feel as a novelist the compunction to tell them as they really are. And that is your duty as a realistic novelist.
Well, one of the things I'm also doing in The Gravedigger's Daughter is I'm showing that in this Darwinian struggle for existence, there are individuals who do survive. And there are high qualities in human experience. I would say the transcendental experience of art and the spiritual products of different kinds, that these things are very real. There is great beauty in the world, and some people put their faith in beauty and creating beauty. And Rebecca has a son who becomes a pianist. And there's a good deal in the novel, whether anyone will even acknowledge it, because people usually just look at the kind of brutal underpinnings. But there's a great deal in the novel about the beauty of music and the power of Beethoven's music to transcend this Darwinian morass.
Yeah, I got all that. I also got the sense that protean identity, which is, of course, characteristic often of the American experience, we can reinvent ourselves, which is essentially she does, as Hazel Jones. She moves into another identity and out of an absolutely untenable and impossible situation.
Yes, it's kind of contrary to a Freudian notion that we're predetermined by about the age of six or so. I think, along with William James, who is our preeminent American philosopher, that our first act of freedom can be to believe in freedom.
You're talking about the anti-Semitism in Germany and tied in with the Holocaust. You even come to it here in the United States in a couple of instances. There's a character named Zimmerman who seems to be actually in some ways kind of a benign character except for his anti-Semitism. And then there's a character later on, Thaddeus Gallagher, the father of this jazz musician who Hazel meets, who seems virulently anti-Semitic. How much of that in your mind was tied with the time that you were working with or the region that you were working with as opposed to something that you see endemic still in America?
Well, it's a different America today. I don't think anti-Semitism is nearly as prevalent today. Some people may say it's smoldering beneath the surface. I don't really feel that or have a sense of that. I'm not that keenly aware of it. But certainly in the 1930s in America, there was plenty of anti-Semitism and discrimination against blacks and ethnic minorities of all kinds. This has always been part of the American dream. You can say the American dream is something very positive, but for some people, it's been the American nightmare. Year after year, there were bills in Congress to outlaw lynching, and year after year, Congress defeated those bills. I can't even remember how many times this happened. Finally, an anti-lynching law was passed. It may have been as late as the 1950s. How would you feel if you were a black person living in a country like that? Then to be Jewish, of course you confronted anti-Semitism, not just in these two men in my novel, but they're just representative. It's not that they disliked or hated individual Jews. They often met people who were Jewish whom they liked very much. These people even loved Rebecca. They didn't know she was Jewish. If Hazel Jones had said, well, actually, I'm Jewish, they would have thought, well, maybe you're Jewish, but we don't mean you. We like you. Some of my best friends are Jews, has been this joke. Because the individual Jew is usually not the one that's hated. It's some sort of vague, mythical, archetypal, fairy tale kind of anti-Jewishness. I don't really understand it. Our species has some sort of predilection. It must be in our genetic makeup toward what's called xenophobia, which is hatred and distrust and fear of someone who's different from us.
You've read Sartre on Jews and antisemitism?
I have a long time ago. Yeah. It's not fresh in my mind.
It's pretty lucid thinking on that score.
Well, he probably makes the case.
It's the other. It's the hatred of the other. Yeah.
Well, that's xenophobia. But also, isn't there a bonding between people who are anti-Semites, as in a lynch mob? if you've seen photographs, there's a whole large book. I don't really recommend it. It's so depressing. But there's a book of photographs of lynchings in America. And you'll see a lynch mob, of course, it's a pure white mob. And you'll be so shocked to see children in it, women who are mothers who are holding their children, and, of course, the men. And all these white people are smiling. Many of them are smiling for the camera. And there's one black body hanging from a tree, and they've killed him. And you can see that these xenophobic actions that are so virulent have a sinister, horrific, but evidently quite natural bonding effect on the crowd or the mob.
Well, there's no lynching in The Gravedigger's Daughter, but there is considerable anti-Semitism from the man who Rebecca thought was her husband, and from him also extreme violence, homicidal violence, again. And you take us into really how that expresses itself and make us wonder, what can motivate it other than just the fact that it is somehow?
Well, Niles Tignor, with whom Rebecca falls in love when she's quite young, is a very strong man. And when we first see him, he protects her. He's very protective. Like men of that type, we call them, not to be comical about it, but these are alpha males, you know. They're called by anthropologists, I guess, or biologists. The alpha male will protect women and children and weaker men. The alpha male can't really deal with another alpha male because they're fated in some ways to fight for that role of domination. But then later on in the novel, Tignor begins to lose his strength. He's been hurt, physically hurt. We feel that he's losing his power. He's involved in some sort of criminal activity, and he's not being successful. Ultimately, he's going to wind up in prison. As soon as he starts losing his sense of masculinity, then he turns mean. And men like that, unless they're very aware of their circumstances and the situation, they will hurt the people in their family. That is, one of the causes of domestic violence is the man who would be protective of his family, who starts being insulted by the outside world. Maybe he loses his job. Maybe something happens to him physically. He's not as strong as he used to be. He becomes depressed and angry, and he takes it on the people who are closest to him.
There seems to be a deep underlying, profound misogyny underneath this protective of my woman when I have the strength to protect her.
Well, most men probably in those days, some decades ago, were misogynist in some way. I think it was the way many people were anti-Semitic in some way, without examining it. Just the attitude people had toward Jews who were not really mean people, but just would say things that are anti-Semitic without even knowing what they were saying. When we traveled in Poland, though maybe I shouldn't get into this, but when we traveled in Poland before the fall of the Berlin Wall, and we were taken around in Warsaw by guides and translators, we heard people say to us things that were very anti-Semitic, but unconsciously. By nice people. I mean, they seem perfectly nice people. They just didn't seem to hear what they were saying.
You have a Jewish family here that quickly becomes disidentified, if there is such a word, from their Jewishness. But they are, with the exception of Rebecca, for the most part, especially there's a lot of ugliness in this family, not only the violence and everything, just the way they're described, foul-smelling and tomato-faced and face red burnt like a tomato, all those kinds of images that suggest the lips and so many things that really bring about almost a feeling of grotesqueness.
But they were so debased. He had been a math teacher in Germany. He lost that. Jacob was forced to live almost like an animal. They came across in this ship. They were ill. They were sick. I don't judge those people at all. I feel very sympathetic with them. One of my favorite characters in the novel is Herschel, the older brother, who lost his German language, and he never learned how to speak English, so he speaks this kind of goofy, primitive American English that's all garbled.
Also a violent character, ultimately.
Yeah, but he's protective, too. He was protective. When the anti-Semites vandalized the cemetery, he took his revenge. I basically don't judge people. I'm sort of presenting them in a very, oddly enough, a very sympathetic light. And I don't even feel that critical of Jacob Swart. My great-grandfather did exactly what he did.
I remember you saying that.
And yeah. I never knew him, and yet I wouldn't judge him. What he did is considered horrific. He committed terrible acts, and ultimately he committed suicide. But I don't judge him. He was desperate. Now, Rebecca, who becomes Hazel Jones, is based really on my grandmother, who did escape that world. And she never talked about the past. She never, never said anything of the kind I'm saying. She had a tragic background, but she was very optimistic. She was so sweet and warm and maternal and grandmotherly. She just turned it all inside out, and whatever misery and sorrow she had in her past, she kept to herself. I thought...
Is she your mother's mother or your father's
mother? My father's mother. I thought that I would write a novel honoring this sort of person who could say, well, I'm a victim, and I've had this terrible background, and I'm not going to be nice to anybody. But she wasn't like that at all. What seemed to me sad now, at my age, is that my grandmother must have been so lonely that she had no one to talk to. There was no one who shared her background. She had no Jewish allegiance. She had no religion. She had no friends, really.
You know, some of these characters are lonely, and it's heart-piercing in many ways. There's I don't want to give a lot of it away, like I said, but there's an epistolary part where she finds a cousin named Frida and writes to her, and then we have letters from her husband's father to her, and he wants to reach out in some way through letters. It's like these people in their isolation and their loneliness need to connect.
Yes, they need to connect.
Yeah.
Yes. But the two cousins do connect in a way. And it's possible that she's going to come to see Rebecca at the end of the novel. So the two cousins were almost like two sisters, and they come together at the end of the novel. For me, that was a happy ending that I think for my grandmother actually never happened. So in the novel, I'm working out a destiny that might have happened.
Well, it certainly touched me, I must tell you. Yes.
But let me just say one more thing. My grandmother, who never ever complained and had no self-pity whatsoever, she lived for her children and she lived for her grandchildren. She was very proud of me. She had wanted my father to be a violinist. And on the wall in my study, I have my father's violin, which my grandmother had bought, and she had no money. She was a factory worker, and she was a chambermaid in a hotel, just like Rebecca. But she and her husband had left her. But she had this yearning and hope that music and art would be a way out.
She worked in a fiber tubing factory, just out of curiosity?
She did work in something like that. Yeah. That's exactly right, yeah.
We're coming toward the break, Joyce. I want to give out the phone number because I know many of your fans always like to talk with you, and there may be some people who have already ingested The Grave Debtor's Daughter, like your humble host here. In fact, let me give out the phone number and invite you to join us with any questions or comments you have for Joyce Carol Oates, one of our certainly most distinguished and prolific writers of both fiction and nonfiction. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, and that will work whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, an opportunity for you to speak with Joyce Carol Oates. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to us, and our email address here is forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Joyce Carol Oates. Her new novel is called The Grave Digger's Daughter. And let's get our callers on here and begin, Leah, with you. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I'm sorry for the scratchiness. I'm on my cell. But I just wanted to say I'm the daughter of survivors, and my father had some of those characteristics where he was. In public, he was quite generous and kind and philanthropic, although he was quite poor. And And at home, he could be very abusive. But what he did with me as his daughter, contrary to what he did with my brother, was that he would be actually incredibly non-supportive. He wouldn't give me anything. He wouldn't tell me anything. He wouldn't really talk to me. And it was kind of mean and abusive. And later in life, as he got older, he finally, near the time when he died, started to explain to me that he felt that I needed, because I was a woman, I needed to be much tougher than any man, because he was always anticipating that the Holocaust was going to happen again, and his sisters had been murdered, and he felt like he needed to make me tough so that I could survive when it happened again.
That's fascinating.
And your story, Lisa, is, I've read books about children as survivors. It's a story that unfortunately has been replicated in different instances in different ways, that is trying to protect children. And that's not Jacob's propensity. Erlotz gives us, unfortunately. But, you know, he's a complicated character because, as you've just described before, he comes out of this with such a sense of bitterness and having faced death and having betrayed and gone through all this. And he becomes, as I said, a grave caretaker. I was interested in that, and I want to talk with you a little bit about that, poor Yorick and all that. But I interviewed Philip Roth in his last novel, and he has a whole science about cemetery keeping and grave digging and so forth. And you've got the water and the smell and, you know, research?
Well, I think it's common sense, but my great-grandfather was a grave digger.
So you knew how to speak.
Well, I knew it in a kind of imaginative way rather than a literal way, but much of it, well, we all walk in cemeteries. We even know what cemeteries are like. And some cemetery caretakers actually live near the cemetery. They're like the caretaker of that property.
And get free rent, like... this family did.
They had to live in a terrible stone hovel. Well, we're talking about 1936. You know, people didn't have indoor plumbing in those days in upstate New York. This was another era. People lived primitively. But to say about Jacob and about this a young woman who just called in with a very touching story, probably her father loved her very much. He loved her so much that he was terrified that she would be hurt by life. Jacob loved his daughter very much that he didn't even speak her name for a year because he felt that she might die. The love comes so strong that people are terrified of it. It's easy to push the person away. It's easy to be nice to people for whom one doesn't feel this strong love. So probably the father loved the daughter very much but just didn't know how to express it.
And also implicit in what you're saying is the dire fear of loss. And the anticipation of loss.
Yes, and every day in the paper we read about women, almost every day, mothers who killed their children, their young children, and then themselves. And people think they're monsters. I don't think they're monsters at all. I think that they feel that life is so painful and so horrific that they want to spare their children the suffering that they have. This is it's a depressed condition. It's not normal. It's not a normal condition, but that is how they feel, that life is very evil, and if you have a child, you brought the child into a world of suffering.
Well, sometimes they can be psychotic, and sometimes when you think about someone like Susan Smith who drove her children into
the water,
it's very
yes.
different.
That
I
was
mean,
premeditated.
She was premeditated. She wanted to be with her boyfriend.
Right? That's right, but I think there are many cases that usually when a woman does that, it's because the boundaries between her and her children have dissolved. And she thinks she has these, she brought them in the world, and she's responsible for them. She wants to die because the world is very painful. She has to take care of them. She doesn't want to leave them behind. It's like a form of euthanasia. I'm not saying that this is a normal reaction at all. Obviously, it's abnormal, but I understand it, and I'm not judging these people.
Your unwillingness to judge has always struck me in many respects because... when you read a story like that, it seems to me you read into the psychology and you become, given your imagination, empathic in ways that probably most people are maybe incapable of doing.
Well, I really don't know how people dare to judge one another. I mean, how dare people judge one another? Where does this come from?
Do you judge President Bush?
I have opinions about him, but that's a whole other subject. You could say that he was elected. Well, maybe he wasn't even elected, but I mean, it is a democracy. People voted for him. He's an expression of some will of some many, many millions of people. So is he acting alone? No. He is basically the same person he was years ago when he was elected. He would have the right to look at around him at his falling polls and say, what's going on? I'm the same man. I have the same ideals. You are the people who are fickle.
But can we judge, should we judge Bin Laden? Should we, I mean, you know, where do you stop with the judgment?
If you were in a position of those people, if you were Bin Laden or the people who so admire him, if you were a Muslim fundamentalist, you would see the whole situation from a very different point of view. You would see us as devils who have interfered around the world and done all sorts of things that seem to you evil. But if you're from your own point of view, these other people seem evil. It's just a split in human subjectivity. What is evil for one group of people is a good to others. The whole thing is completely subjective. That seems to be a fairly self-evident anthropological insight.
But, you know, I'm thinking about an interview I did with Cynthia Ozick where she was talking about Bin Laden and saying, using Twain's phrase of evil joy in murdering people. Why shouldn't we judge that? I mean, and I think she's right about that. There was evil joy throughout the Muslim world.
Well, I'm not at all defending these people.
No, I understand, but you don't want to judge them.
No, but let me say, are they just doing this out of a caprice? There is a political history. There is always a political history to acts of terrorism.
Here's what I don't understand when we bring in judgment to that. There are those in Chile afflicted by another 9/11 and the overthrow of the ENE government and hurt more by the United States, one could argue, than, say, a billionaire from Yemen, which was what Bin Laden was, or hurt more politically even. In Latin America and Vietnam, there's been more damage done, let's say, by the United States than there has, one could argue, in parts of the Middle East, like Yemen. Shouldn't one make a judgment in terms of evil being done? It's not been done by Vietnamese like it has been done by, say, Bin Laden. It's not been done by Chileans like it was done by Bin Laden.
Well, I'm not at all defending these people, and I'm not that much of a political person, and I'm not a historian, but I think when you use a word like evil, it's a loaded word. We were evil, with quotation marks around it. At the time of the American Revolution, we seemed like evil traitors to the English and to the Loyalists. What we were doing was an act of rebellion. We were traitors to the crown, the English crown. But I don't feel that the American rebels and the revolution were evil. They seem heroic to us. It's just a point of view. But when you use a theological term like evil and good and assign evil to your enemies, you're just not looking at the political and historical nuances. I'm sure an Islamic historian would sit at this place that I'm sitting in and tell you 1,200 things, some reasons why acts of terrorism are being committed.
But there are Islamic historians and Islamic theologians who would never
Never
countenance it, exactly.
But they would explain why.
But that's a judgment. To countenance or not to countenance is a judgment.
But they wouldn't say it was evil.
They might.
Well, they might say it was confused or ignorant or short-term actions.
But I've heard Islamic scholars say when people are killed capriciously and they're innocent people, this is evil.
I mean, well, it's terrorism. This is what we mean by terrorism. The IRA has committed acts of terrorism. Nonetheless, in this country, there's been a lot of sentiment and sympathy for the Irish effort under the IRA, but they've been terrorists also. Terror is considered a desperate political action by people who feel they can't make their political wishes known in any other way. And certainly, I'm not defending it. Please don't understand it. I'm just questioning the use of theological terms like evil. Because if somebody else is evil, you're just saying implicitly that you're good.
Actually, Christopher Hitchens was on about a week and a half ago talking about his new book, God is Not Great. It's an atheist tract, really, essentially. And he said, I'm an atheist, and I don't hesitate to use the word evil. I think there's a palpable sense of, in fact, you've got evil in it. You had another serial killer in this novel. You seem to come back to them from time to time, like Arnold Friend in one of your most famous stories.
Well, I almost never use the word evil, though. I'm surprised Christopher Hitchens would use that because it's so theologically determined.
It's a signifier that has all kinds of theological associations, but I think what he was saying was that, you know, there are people who are just demonic, diabolical.
Or psychotic.
Or psychotic.
Well, look at this way. If a young man, a Palestinian, for instance, a young man becomes a suicide bomber, he thinks, in our opinion, he's confused. He thinks that by acting, by being a martyr, he goes to heaven. Now, he seems to believe that. Would you say that's evil, or is that just confusion?
Or maybe in his mind it's the antithesis of evil, which is what you're saying. It's virtue because it will elevate him to heaven, right?
He's a martyr. We have a tradition of martyrs in the Christian church also. But I wouldn't say that he's acting evil in an evil way. I would say he was acting in a very confused, to me, a confused and blind way. I would never believe in that kind of martyrdom because I don't believe in that heaven to come. And the whole theological structure there that supports a suicide bomber is not anything we can countenance. But to call it evil just seems to be to put a stamp on it so that you're not any longer trying to understand it.
Our guest is Joyce Carol Oates. Her new novel is The Gravedigger's Daughter. And join us. Aisha, good morning.
Good morning. I just have a comment about the discussion around judgment. I think that it's okay to have judgment as long as you're aware that it's a judgment. And, I mean, sure, killing is inherently wrong and the acts of terrorism have resulted in evil, but that the motivations are evil, I don't completely agree, and I completely agree with the comments being made that they're acts of desperation or confusion or brainwashing and the various judgments that we have around that. It's okay to think that that's evil as long as you're aware that's your singular perspective and that's coming from your eyes and your collection of experiences. So that was just a comment I wanted to add to the discussion.
We thank you for adding it, Joyce Carol Oates.
That's very sensible. Man, that's just common sense. I think what this young woman has said.
Here's Kim, who writes, a noted psychotherapist once said, when they passed out bodies, they passed out personalities, and it's one to a customer. In this hour, you have expressed agreement with aspects of both genetic predisposition and freedom of choice, or similar words to that effect. Could you comment a bit further on your thoughts about the conjunction of the two? Nature-nurture, there you go.
Well, I think we have to believe in freedom. We have to believe in freedom and self-definition. Our species is the only species that learns so much from the environment and from one another. A person's life can be completely changed in childhood by having a dedicated teacher, by having a mentor in high school or in college, someone who is really, really dedicated as a teacher, someone who cares about you. And by contrast, a person can be left behind who doesn't have that, who comes from a family or a background that doesn't review books or education, is made to go out and work when he or she is a child, and never even has a chance to an opportunity to be educated. So I think that we have enormous range of possibilities for all of us. I mean, you and I, who are sitting here talking with each other this morning, had we been born a couple decades earlier in America, we wouldn't be here because we probably wouldn't have had the same opportunities. I barely had these opportunities. I went to a one-room schoolhouse for 6 years because there was redistricting in my school. In the county. So then I was sent to a city school and where I learned something. And then I went to a suburban high school where I was prepared for college. But that was only an accident. That was an accident of time. I came along at a time in American history, at least in upstate New York, when there weren't even school buses. If I had lived about 5 miles from the school, I don't know how I would have gotten to school. I had to walk about 2 miles, and that was fine. I could do that. All these things are accidental, but we are the species that can learn from one another and from books and from history and from the wisdom of the past, and we can elect to learn of our own free will. I have always elected to learn whatever I could.
And speaking of Upper State New York, you're back there. Place has always been important to you, and you're back up in around Niagara in that area. In this novel, once again, you keep going back. You went back with The Falls, with your recent novel, The Falls, which was a national bestseller.
Well, and then my next novel is going to be set in New Jersey.
Sopranos inspired, perhaps. Here's another listener. This is Peter, who says, I've always wondered if there's an established survival benefit to xenophobia. People are afraid to discuss this because we don't want to admit to our dark sides. But speaking as a dispassionate scientist, if there is indeed a deeply ingrained tendency to xenophobia, there must be a scientific explanation, just as we also seek explanations for altruism. I can imagine what the benefits might be, but I would hate to voice them because it's so easy for non-scientists to confuse scientific explanation with moral justification, to confuse is with should be.
Well, that's a very rational and sensible statement. Of course, xenophobia, since it exists, it's so prevalent in all peoples, it has to have an evolutionary advantage to it.
Here's another listener opining along these lines. I thought this tied in with your discussion. Scott writes, group instinct, which may have served our ancestors in identifying other members of our tribe versus those outside our tribe, would have been a desirable trait. I would expect it to be hardwired in the animal brain. A higher concept like altruism allows an individual to pass beyond the boundary of tribe to help others. More primitive endeavors, like religion, play on the group instinct to enhance and enforce boundaries and encourage discrimination.
Beautifully phrased and very sensible also. And I think that one could add art and certain spiritual endeavors and idealistic endeavors along with the things that that person has said.
And if you'd like to say something here, by the way, our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. Here's a listener who writes, Miss Oates, aggressive women aren't admired? Nonsense. I'm both, as are many of my friends. I'm admired in part because I am aggressive. I exercise my rights, express my opinions, fight for the people and causes I believe in. I think you confuse aggression with belligerence or hostility.
Well, I'm sure that there are many strong women who are admired. I've been thinking of Hillary Clinton, who's just the ceaseless target. She's a woman of such exceptional gifts and energy and ambition, and she's held to some very high standard that most men are never held to. Every time she turns around, she's being criticized. I was thinking of someone like Hillary Clinton, whom so many people dislike.
Here's another listener who says, Miss Oates, could it be hatred of the other seems less inexplicable when we consider that its alternative means opening up to hatred of the self?
Well, I don't see that as an either-or. I think altruism, which is the opposite of xenophobia, brings with it a great deal of happiness, that we're happier when we're nicer to other people. I know that I feel happier about myself if I'm generous. One of the reasons I like to teach is that it's an opportunity for me to help students realize their own potential. And I'm virtually never critical of the students. I try to be very constructive. I'm not sure that that's altruism exactly.
It may be doing a disservice, though. Forgive me for saying that. You know, there are, I remember Flannery O'Connor once made a remark about there are too many writers out there and too many people encouraged to be writers who perhaps should not be writers.
Oh, I think that was a cruel statement. I think that was mean. That was vicious. It was really vicious. How about all the people, especially women and girls, who were never, ever encouraged to express themselves, who were laughed at and jeered and mocked by people like Flannery O'Connor? She's basically saying, shut up. She's saying, shut up. You're not as good as I am.
Well, she's also saying maybe, like you can, and this is judgment again, perhaps, people try out for a basketball team. Not everybody's going to make it. There are some better basketball players than there are others. And some,
yes, but, but basketball can be fun. You can play basketball.
Of course, and people could write for their own reasons.
And
but there are people who think that they're going to become writers in a way that will gain recognition.
How do
so
you
forth.
Know that they think that? Most people
I did.
Most people I know who want to write are just very humble and modest, and they want to see what they can do. If somebody's standing over them and saying, give up before they've even started, I think that's cruel. The same thing is true for music. You don't have to be such a great musician that you're playing at Carnegie Hall. You can get much happiness out of music on a much more humble and modest scale. I mean, most people are never going to be great musicians.
You've got two characters in your book, though, who are quite talented, and one is a prodigy.
But they work very hard. The average person doesn't have to work that hard. Just to take music lessons once a week and play piano on whatever level you're on is a very happy thing. You don't really deserve somebody making fun of you for that.
What about the people, though, who think they can be really outstanding as musicians or as writers,
well,
and who are deceiving themselves?
But who are these people? Are there really a lot of them?
I think there are legion numbers of them, actually, yeah. I think there are a lot of people, in fact, who think they're artists and who would love to be artists, and aspire to it who don't have it within them to produce the kind of art that would get them, let's say, what they feel their ambition is trying to reach?
I don't think there are that many of those people. We would call them deluded. Most of the people I meet who are trying to be writers who are writing are very modest in their goals. They're working on one project. They might be working on a memoir or a novel or some poetry. They're not setting out to win the Nobel Prize. I think it's cruel to say to people that either you have to be great and win the Nobel Prize or you should give up. Most people are never going to be on that level. It's cruel and it's also very silly.
When you encourage a writer like you did as a teacher, Jonathan Safran Foer was one of your students, I believe.
Yes, he was. Yeah.
And you see real talent like that as opposed to, say, someone who is trying to write and just doesn't have that kind of talent. There's still a desire in you to encourage them in the same way?
I don't know what we're talking about, really. Who are these people who are so incompetent?
I didn't use the word incompetence. I'm saying someone who, let's say, is ordinary or pedestrian as a writer, but who wants to be talented and doesn't have the talent.
I don't think that this is ever an issue. When you're a teacher, if you're teaching students, it's your duty to teach them to write a little bit better. Whoever comes in a workshop or a class with me, that person, male or female, is going to write better and think more sensitively about literature after one semester, because it's my duty as a teacher to help that person.
Yeah, I share the responsibility as a teacher. You bring the person up to whatever level that person is capable of.
And what people sometimes learn when they're in, an art class, a music class, a math class, a chemistry class, they learn by looking around at the other students that they're not as good. Nobody has to hit them over the head and make fun of them and say, you're not talented. In music especially, people look around, they listen to what the others are producing. They know that they're not on that level. That happens very often. In a workshop in which Jonathan Safran Foer was a student, the other students probably looked at him and looked at their own work, and they got it.
There's a kind of egalitarianism, though, that especially seems characteristic of preschools and has gone all the way up to the universities and so forth, that says everybody should make an effort, and everybody who makes an effort. I mean, kids are told all the time that in supportive ways to enhance their self-esteem, that's great, that's wonderful when they produce something, let's say, on a canvas or whatever. Where does judgment come in? Where should a child be told, you've got some real talent, or, you know, are you disabusing or disillusioning the child to think that they have talent when they don't?
I think that most teachers are very sensitive to the potentiality that students have, and that we do encourage students who seem to have some talent. And as I said, there's a sense that people learn from one another also in these classes. I don't see that egalitarianism is a great evil, to use that word. And to me,
it's a religious word, right?
But to make that some sort of an issue seems very strange, because I come from a world that was very harsh and judgmental. And when I was at the university, when I was a student, grades were listed on the walls in front of the professor's offices. When you got your exam grade, it was listed very visibly. And most people got C's in those days. People got D's and F's. Some people got B's, and just a few people got A's.
Pre-grade inflation.
That was very vicious, and it was very pitiless. That it seems to me that egalitarianism is not worse than that, because when people get out into the world, they're going to find out soon enough the hierarchy. Yeah, they'll find it out soon enough.
Let me find out what some of our callers have to say. Jillian, good morning.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment mostly about what you're saying, Michael, about discouraging or not encouraging people who, quote-unquote, don't have the talent. Why not? I mean, what is the problem? So what if they are not going to make it to Carnegie Hall, or they'll never be published writers, or they won't show their art in galleries? What harm are they doing to even be deluded, you know, as you said? I don't see the big deal. I don't understand why you feel it's so important to let them know that they're not as good as maybe some other people.
Oh, I agree with that. That's absolutely true. I know people who are older who've had difficult lives. They've lost their spouses, and they're elderly and retired, and they're senior citizens taking classes and writing, and they're writing their memoirs. And they are so happy and so excited about doing this. It's so thrilling to them to share their memoirs with one another. Now, maybe if a critic from the New York Times looked at what they've written, he would ridicule it and laugh at it because it's not great. But as I say, who cares?
Let me thank Jillian for the call. Actually, here are a couple of emails that pose different points of view. This is June, who says, Miss Oates' ideas about judgment and evil are perplexing. She mentioned that martyrdom is within the Christian tradition. Yes, but Christian martyrs were killed by others because of their beliefs. Palestinian suicide bombers are not confused. They are considered martyrs because they have murdered people. They are motivated by hatred. Is it possible for Miss Oates to feel no judgment when she's faced with people who tell her, if you don't believe the way I do, I have the right to kill you? And one more email. To say that you never judge people is immature and self-serving. Oates is resorting to absolute relativism, which is a completely useless framework for living, and she should know better. Just my two cents. Getting somewhat hostile remarks.
Well, these people feel very confident in judging, much more than I do.
Well said. Thank you for being with us this hour. I hate to end on that note, but it was a very humble remark that you ended with, and I think that's a good place to conclude with your humility. Again, the novel is called The Gravedigger's Daughter. Joyce Carol Oates, the author, always a pleasure to have her with us on Forum. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening, and remind you that you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in line at 415-553-3300. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal and Kevin Guillory, production assistants from Christina Shaheen, Elsa Chang, and Sharon Adam. Our interns are Monica Arora, Chimrit Berman, Noor Dawood, Cecilia Kauth, Naira Derkaregian, and Stephen Marchand. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED, thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.